It's a pleasure to talk about this book, which was actually published in towards the end of 2011, and it's already quite a while. And I'm very happy to go back to it because it's somehow my favorite piece of work. It was researched and published by the Jan Van Eyck Academy, where I was a fellow, as Patricia said. And somehow the title is a provocation. And in order to answer this question, I'm somehow referred to the analysis of the book. In order to somehow give you a structure, a pointer, somehow how the book relates to the question or to the conflict between money and art, I would suggest or indicate three different ways that this question could be answered. So the first, and I guess the most direct way, has to do with the aesthetic qualities of money, the money as an object, and here refer to currency, and both to notes and to coins, and somehow how currencies create a very interesting aesthetic statement about questions of value, identity, culture, history, even territoriality, and how this somehow could be an example of a good artwork or a good cultural object. A different way to relate money and art is somehow to relate to the discourses that these two things relate, namely economics and aesthetics. And somehow the second way to address this question is to somehow point or to imply that economics somehow provides a more interesting way to make sense of the relationship between the individual and its environment. And the third, and I guess more provocative answer, has to do with economics as a way, or money as a way, to address and attack this idea of the autonomy of the arts, of the autonomy of the artistic practice. And somehow I could start arguing on these kind of three levels, but in order to somehow argue and to explain these conclusions, I have to somehow go and present the whole analysis of the book. So somehow I'm going to first, let's say, describe what I did in this book, and I will leave the answer to somehow linger on our minds, and also on these three ways this answer is this question can be answered, and in the end of the analysis of the book, we could come back to the question and the answers and see how much they could be defended or they follow from the analysis of the book. So the book is called The Notes Towards a Critique of Money, and somehow there is a relationship. This work that Baudrillard did in the early 80s, which was entitled Notes Towards a Critique of Political Economy. And what Baudrillard tried to do in this book is to complete, let's say, the critique of political economy from the Marxist tradition by integrating or including the idea of the sign. And somehow in my work, what I'm doing, or the further step I walk towards that direction, has to do with this substituting, or let's say, changing the focus from the commodity form to the money form. And this is somehow also suggests one of the main discourses that I'm working with, structuralism, and especially Baudrillardian structuralism. The second is Lacanian psychoanalysis, and it's going to be also very prominent. And the third has to do with my work as an economist, and also my training in the methodology of economics. And the argument of the book is somehow based in this kind of four basic points. There is this idea of the understanding of money, the definition of money as a standard of abstract value, and the whole philosophy of value that is somehow underlies this understanding of money. A critique of the methodology of economics that has to do with this description of economics as a separate and an exact science. Structuralism, that already somehow talked about or hinted at through the reference to Baudrillard, and of course psychoanalysis. And it's all these four points somehow relate to each other, and the first two somehow clear the ground by criticizing economics and trying to debunk this idea of equilibrium analysis as a way to explain but also to impose the market as an ideal mechanism of social organization. And the second part has to do with this more structural analysis of economics that refers not so much on the content, on the arguments that economics uses in order to promote itself and explain its dominance, but to suggest how specific structures in language and in money lead to this kind of analysis and this kind of conclusion. The last part of psychoanalysis somehow tries to explain how this ideological discourse of economics and the structure that supports it sticks to the individual psyche. So there is a little bit of analysis on the process of subjectivation and the articulation of desire that somehow supports the ideological analysis of economics. Just a little point. My accent is obviously very Greek, so sometimes people don't quite follow. And also, I don't know if I speak fast or slow or loud, but the gentleman in the front likes it, but I don't know. How about in the back? Is it okay? So as I said, the starting point has to do with the theory of value and the analysis of money. And I would suggest that there is this kind of small Kantian point about this idea of value not being a property of things, but more or less a system of organization of objects in a taxonomy. And this Kantian twist has to do also with this idea of being, that being is not a property of objects. Because when we say that something exists or something has value, it doesn't change the very identity of the object. And this is somehow the argument that this kind of famous German philosopher called Georg Simmel, who's written this book, The Philosophy of Money, did in order to somehow argue for this kind of relational understanding of value. So what Simmel said, and what all this tradition coming from Simmel, going through analytic philosophy and embracing, I would say, the state theory of money and institutional economics argues, is that value is abstract and value is has to do with a process of subjective valuation becoming intersubjective and socialized. So there is this kind of idea of people having a specific vantage point to the world that organize objects in a system of valuation. In economics, this is predominantly encountered as a system of prices, and how the system of prices through the interaction of individuals becomes objectified. This is somehow an important point of departure from more mainstream or neoclassical analysis of economics, where somehow there is this idea of value as something that is embodied in the object. And this is more about money and this idea of commodity money and less about objects and commodities. So there's this big divide between money as an abstract symbol, as a signifier, and this is something that we uncover further in our analysis, and this idea of money as an embodiment of value when we see this commodity money, gold as money, silver as money. And this is, I guess, a first breaking point of this analysis with mainstream economics. And mainstream economics very much also talks about value, but comes from a completely different idea. And this idea has to do with this market and general equilibrium, where all these kind of subjective valuations that I referred to before come together and are negotiated. And through this maximizing behavior of individuals, we get to a kind of a price that clears the economic system. So what is interesting in this case is that money comes as a way of expressing this individual valuation, this negotiation of individual valuation. So money is a means of exchange that just expresses valuation. In the previous, I would say, framework, money has a much more active role. Money is somehow the reference point that objectifies this valuation. It's not the market, the institution of the market, but the institution of the of money. And how is this kind of equilibrium analysis supported? There is this very basic assumptions about maximization, rationality, full information. There are also some more technical, this idea of constant returns to scale or marginal, diminishing returns, and the marginal rate of substitution also declining in order to somehow preclude the possibility of monopolies that define the price. And if all these kind of principles apply, then we can have an economic system that clears and brings about the state of equilibrium. And this is somehow important to keep in mind, because this kind of very abstract and very unrealistic assumption needs to be in place in order to have an equilibrium state, in order for the market to clear. What I'm trying to suggest here is that the economic system, the system of the market, in order to have this kind of ability to find the price where we have optimal conditions, where supply equals demand, we have a very restrictive set of assumptions that have to be in place. And this is a very, ideal system. These assumptions do not apply, and this is also somehow the very realization of economists themselves. What the economists do is they provide an ideal system that can function as a benchmark that other institutions should aspire to. So economists argue that if we were able to build the conditions of a perfect market, of perfect competition, we would have a system that will be optimal in terms of welfare, where it's and every individual would be able to maximize and given its property and its endowments somehow get the optimal solution without a need of any coordination, but also without somehow having to mind about the consequences of its actions. So we have a system that it's both welfare optimizing and morally somehow acceptable, and where individual freedom is somehow celebrated. Each and everyone can act as if maximizing his or her own interest, and that could lead to an ideal state where everybody would be happy. And this ideal state would be also somehow the optimal solution for the economic problem. What is interesting about this economic system is, on the one hand, its ideal character, but also how this kind of system could be applicable outside economics. Economic science has this interesting particularity that it doesn't define itself in terms of a specific subject matter. Let's say a specific set of relationship or a specific geographical area, but it's a kind of a system of organization that could be applied in any case where questions of wealth or questions of value are at stake. So what is really somehow relates to this description of economics as a separate and an exact science? The separate character of economics is that it defines itself not in terms of a specific domain, but in terms of specific problems. So whenever there's a problem of maximization, be it in a family relationship, in environmental conditions, in education, in culture, economists can provide a specific methodology. So it's not constrained by the nature of the problem, but more about the outcome that it's somehow aimed at. So this is the first element of economic analysis. The second element has to do with an exact character of economics, and that it's this has to do with the fact that the restrictive assumptions of general equilibrium analysis are idealizations, and they don't apply in real life. So what economics offers is somehow partial solutions or benchmarks or a specific sense of direction where social problems or social analysis is pursued. What I'm trying to argue here is that the whole edifice of economics has its own limitations that are somehow ingrained in its very reasoning, in its separate and inexact character. And in that sense, we could argue that this normative character of economics has to a very kind of specific direction, specific limitations. And this brings me to the more structuralist, I would say, analysis of economics. It has to do with the fact that economics is supported or is based on this bifurcation between individual needs and utility, between value and exchange. And somehow this is the critique that Baudrillard is trying to wage in his analysis of the political economy of design. The question is not that capitalism is a travesty, is a somehow simplification of social relations. Our critique can only be complete if we see how this organization of social relationships is connected to the structure of language or the structure of commodity, how economics finds a way to replicate itself by connecting or by imitating the structure of language. And this is somehow how the analysis of money and the analysis of value come together. And also how the critique of money is going to develop in the further on in the argument. So my analysis of money has this very strong structuralist sense, because I'm trying to point to the relationship between the circulation of meaning and the operation of language, and the circulation of commodities and the creation of the system of meaning in the market. And this is very much connected to the process of signification. So there is this very basic idea that language could be underside, could be explained as an interplay of signifiers, as a system of signs, where each and every signifier refers to another signifier, where meaning is somehow a chain that is organized by relationships of identity and differences. And somehow the same kind of relationships is apparent in the interplay of commodities, in the exchange of commodities in terms of value. So on the one hand we have meaning, and on the other hand have value as the common denominator of the two systems. Circulation is the principle of both systems, but how the circulation is organized has to do with a kind of a different relationship, on the one hand to meaning, on the other hand to value. And this, I would say, structuralist analysis of money and of value is interesting because it also builds a bridge to the question of psychoanalysis that we're going to see immediately after. But before I move to that, I have to, I will read, sorry for the abrupt interruption, but so, revisiting the political economy of the sign, this is part of the book. Sorry. Yes, here we are. Money, value, and price are equivalent to the trinity of signification, referring to the signifier, the signified, and the sign. If we juxtapose the structure of signification to the structure of commodification, we will be able to recognize the isomorphisms that illuminate the structural principle behind the production of meaning in capitalism. The analogy between linguistic signification and the system of prices, between sign and price, and between money and the signifier is recognized by Saussure and further investigated by Baudrillard. Words are signs made up of a specific signifier and related to a particular signifier. The signifier, the form of the sign, whether phonic or graphic, make the circulation of language possible. Prices are also signs, always expressed by money, the master signifier of economic value, and related to specific commodity. They regulate the production, distribution, and consumption of commodities. The abstraction of social reality in a system of exchange of commodities, represented by a set of equations and resulting in the general equilibrium of supply and demand, is the mathematical expression of the ideological form of the capitalist symbolic order. The traditional dichotomies between reality, false consciousness, subject and object, infrastructure and superstructure are reduced to just ideological constructions that mirror the dual character of the price form and sign form. They are examples of how the symbolic order legitimizes itself by referring to a sense of reality that is implied by these dichotomies. The ideological form creates these false controversies only to resolve them in the process of legitimizing itself. All these tensions emerge from an artificial separation between the ideological content and its mirror that is marketed as reality, which follows the same duality of structural principle. It makes little difference whether it's the context of material production or the imaginary context of signification. It is the structural principle that it is determinant. The rules of bifurcation and separation of form and content, the dominance of the signifier of the signified. We can unmask and resolve the mystification of the social symbolic system of production only if this artificial separation is destroyed. What I'm pointing out here is that there is this common structure of bifurcation. We have on the one hand the sign, on the other hand we have the commodity. We have on the one hand the price, and on the other hand we have the money. The structure is the same, the systems are different, but somehow what is interesting is to see how the market mechanism is basically using the same system of meaning as language. And it's also very interesting to see how this structure is somehow anchored on the individual psyche, how psychoanalysis comes together with economics in this analysis of the ideological form of capitalism. The starting point in psychoanalysis has to do again with language, or at least in this Lacanian school of psychoanalysis that I'm using. Famously, Lacan said that the unconscious is structured like a language. And this somehow has to do or refers to the fact that the subject and its desire is always somehow related with language, with the insertion of the subject in language. What is at stake for how the subject is created has to do with certain mandates that are given by the environment, by language. And here, by language, I refer to a more broad understanding of a cultural system. Language includes also social roles, it includes relations, it includes culture itself. So, what Lacan argues when it suggests that the subject is not something given but is a choice or a mandate that the individual has to assume in the process of becoming a person, refers to the fact that each and every one of us has to choose from given specific roles in the society. These roles are always communicated by languages. So we can be sons or daughters, we can be parents, we can be workers, we can be teachers, we can be bosses. But all these kind of possibilities are already given, are already saved by our environment. And there is always somehow a distance between what we really are and all these kind of different positions and languages. And the modern, this kind of process is a tendency to somehow try to fulfill a specific kind of desire, to go back to this kind of how the lack between the need and the object that fulfills this need is fulfilled in the symbolic order, in the system of meaning. And in this process of choosing specific kind of instances of subjectification, the subject tries to find the position in the symbolic order. And if we somehow connect this analysis of Lacan of becoming a subject and finding a place in the symbolic order with this kind of Baudrillardian analysis of the market as a system of meaning, where money is the signifier that creates coherence by providing this unified substance of value, we can really see the process of subjectivation in the market in kind of structuralist psychoanalytic terms. So this idea of self-actualization could be understood as a process of finding specific kind of roles in the market. And again, this kind of gap between individual identity, individual history, and the specific possibilities that the system has in store from the individual expresses itself. So we see that the same kind of conflict between signifier and signified in the process of becoming a subject, in the process of fulfilling one's desire and finding the object of enjoyment. So this process somehow of becoming, of enjoyment, of fulfilling one's desires is somehow very much regulated by the market and regulated by money. And this is somehow certain mechanism that this process is organized. There's this idea of commodification of desire, where the individual tries to fulfill his or her own needs by finding specific commodities in the market, where these commodities are not so much the object of desire, but the very articulations of desire. There is this idea of alienation and separation, where the subject somehow tries to bridge the gap between his own self-perception and the valorization of him or herself in the market by assuming specific roles as producer and consumer. There is subjection to the symbolic order. There is this introduction of the subject into the into language by accepting or internalizing specific mandates. There is this process of metonymy contestation, where somehow specific traces of one's desire are invested in language in this process of finding the object of desire. And there is this whole affective tension that supports this kind of desire economy between desire and lack, between the object and the subject. I'm gonna somehow try to close and go to the again to the basic question that we started by, making a last point about this kind of desire and lack, and how money intervenes as a signifier of this lack. And what is interesting in the process of consumption is that the different possibilities, the incessant engagement of the subject in the market, and the endless chain of commodities, the endless promise of enjoyment is always somehow moved, or always transferred to the next commodity. So there is this ideal of, let's say, complete or final enjoyment that the subject is always promised in his interaction, in his involvement in the marketplace. And this promise is always somehow mediated and communicated by money. Money, as the signifier of value, suggests the amount of enjoyment that a specific act of consumption has. And here we have to remember this kind of starting point of psychoanalytic theory that suggests that the object of desire is always articulated by language, always articulated by the environment, always articulated by the symbolic order. So money, by intervening in this process between enjoyment and desire, between lack and object, between meaning and the subject, is somehow the focal point of the process of enjoyment of the individual. Money always intervenes between the subject and its enjoyment. So in that sense, money is ever present in his process of integrating in the symbolic order, be it the market or the society. And in that sense, money as a master signifier assumes a further very important function as the object cause of desire. By giving the meaning to commodities, by supporting commodities with this halo of value and enjoyment, it takes the place of the object cause of desire. And this is, again, somehow the four possibilities of arguing why money is more appealing than art. The first one is already, I suggested it, the idea that money is the object cause of desire, because exactly it intervenes between the subject and its object of enjoyment. It's also the structural principle of market ideology, because it is the form that somehow enforces the bifurcation between subject and object, between commodity and value, between production and consumption. So in that sense, money is the master signifier, the organizing principle of the market discourse. I also suggested that money is the master signifier. And the last and somehow a different way to understand money is the omnipresent, the ever existing, all powerful representation of the capitalist symbolic order, of the big other. Whenever the individual has to find a place in the environment, this integration is also somehow conditioned by money. Money decides the value of this instance, is the system that valorizes how the contribution of the subject is to be evaluated at this very point, and somehow is the reminder of the presence of the subject in the symbolic order. Thank you.
Just like about the second, the sort of last part of the presentation, because obviously it's the most fresh. Of course, I'm not expecting you to be an expert Lacanian, so if this part of Lacan is not the same, just say it isn't the problem. But it seemed like your apprehension was also very contingent on the relation between desire and lack.
Mm-hmm.
And I would I've heard other, fairly convincing other Lacanian diagnoses which would put it more in the realm of drive, which is precisely what you can't fulfill. And you get pleasure because you never achieve your goal. Whereas a desire, if I have enough of the mitigating principle of money, I can achieve and I can fulfill that lack. But this kind of circuit, what's called Jody Dean calls it like circuits of drive. So this is the kind of mechanism where it's just constantly going, that it never reaches a state, it can never be fulfilled. And I'm wondering how that relates to the beginning part where you start introducing the neoclassical model, which as a layman I understood were more or less under that paradigm of the money as commodity in itself. So I could never, in that way, it's not about fulfilling, it's not about the relationship between me and acquiring this speaker that I desire. It's about purely acquiring more commodity, because the money itself is a commodity.
So there are two parts. So I don't know about them, my mom. So there is this desire to desire. We desire to desire this. I guess that's the definition of drive. I think my take, and that's why I put Todd McGowan's point, and I don't know if it was so clear, but there's this idea of partial enjoyment versus total enjoyment. And somehow what capitalism offers, or how capitalism works, is this idea of having it all. You can have it all, and this is somehow the name of the game. And partial enjoyment is somehow an enjoyment of the lack, a realization of the inability not to have it all. And this process somehow creates the impulse for more and more consumption, because it's kind of a game without an end. And exactly because money intervenes, and money is the kind of the incarnation of prohibition, that's why I refer to it as the big other. Exactly because it's the point where consumption stops, where enjoyment stops, there is somehow this kind of transference towards money rather than the object of enjoyment. And of course, exactly because there is kind of this intervention, there is this kind of, I would say, prohibition, the desire of the subject remains active. Because there is this possibility to fulfill one's own hopes for enjoyment. The market can go on. The more you consume, the more you want. That's the somehow. And money comes there and then stops, keeps this process active. So the second part of the question has to do, can you? Because I had it, but
I was just curious how, if when we speak about money as this kind of relational thing, the mediator between what I desire and what I lack, versus a neoclassical model where it could be situated within the paradigm of drive, because money in itself is a commodity. So there's never going to be a fulfilling of the lack. There's just an endless, it's more like a process of accumulation. It's not about a it's not about redeeming tokens in a sense, where I can bring this money object and be fulfilled. The money itself is the
Well, the difference in my analysis has to do with the understanding of value and also utility. So somehow I suggest that money is the signifier of utility. Money is the signifier of enjoyment. And this has to do more with the fact that it's like two things. On the one hand, it's this kind of psychoanalytic idea that the object of desire is not articulated, never articulated. So individual has to go to the market and be taught what to desire. Mm-hmm. And the signifier of this desire is money, is the price. So the more expensive food is, the more, the better it tastes. This is the one thing. And, you know, usually in the classical economics, we know what we want and utility is there and we know how much we enjoy. And money is just the convenience. So we know how much things work and we know what we want. So everything is, if the subject is given, the object of desire is given, and also the price is somehow given. Money intervenes only as a convenience to provide a common denominator of these values. Values are known to everybody now. And in a perfect system, you don't even need money because you have kind of barter coordinated, and then there is no problem. And then this idea of money as a commodity to be consumed, somehow this, I think that somehow I don't know how this structurally would work, because the thing is that in this system, money provides the common substance, value, or kind of signifier of enjoyment, if you like. And what is in the end consumed is not the object itself, but this meaning of enjoyment. So it's like what we get is not so much the very act of enjoying, but we get the meaning of what we're doing through money, through this kind of signaling mechanism of the money system. So we consume money as a kind of, money is the stimuli and we consume something else.
Okay.
What I like in this analysis is kind of the relational aspect of money as a power, agency, as a what implies when I have money, we are thinking about lack of money, maybe we're thinking of our situation. But when I do own a lot of money, then it's not so much the drive because I lack and I want more, it's the drive because of possibilities of the agency. There's the power of the infinity that offers. Because everybody wants money, so you can actually do anything you want, so you want to do more than anything what you want. And I think that's a crucial aspect also to think about money in a relational aspect. As we think about the shift, that there's this one mountain of money hoarding with less and less people, and more people like without money. If money is not if it would just be a mediator, but what is it? What is the significance of the money? Maybe it's not even about significance, but what's the effect?
I would say that money is somehow empty because it refers to itself. There is nothing that...
Yeah.
So in that sense, the significance of money is that it can give significance to everything else because it's an empty signifier. And in that sense, it also helps to close this signifying chain of all the other commodities by providing this common substance of value that is actually nothing. The value of things is... There is not nothing. It's like you can say that something weighs and so on, or it has this length, but value is somehow something that has to refer to money. And it cannot refer to money because money is nothing. So that, in that sense, that's the functionality of money. But the question of power is interesting in the sense that it refers to kind of a more political aspect of money and money as a relationship. But I think the power aspect is much more visible to the subordinate parts, to the people who are oppressed, than to the people who have this power. In the sense that I think that you cannot have enough money, so the people who rich and poor people suffer the same from this kind of alienating effect of money. They enjoy.
It's completely different. It's not suffering. I think it's a completely different thing. If you are rich and you want more, or if you are poor and you want enough. It's quality sense. It's a different.
Obviously, but
I think you meant it in the abstract way, like.
Yeah, but that's what I'm exactly liking, because if this conversation always stays in this abstract way, it stays really... Also, it's not relating. If the conversation is not relating, you will never get the stage where a relational aspect is becoming like really tangible in the work.
In my analysis, maybe this is a problem. I can see that. Needs are not given, even like somebody who doesn't have enough to eat. I think this kind of hunger is also somehow constituted by language. It's not... I understand that it's a physical, you know, if you don't eat, you die, but eating so much kind of mediated by society, even in people who are having almost nothing, that this is somehow... And it's not so much about the subsistence part of eating, but the experience of eating as a social as something that is kind of a learned social attribute. You are somehow enculturating and satisfied even at your basic desires. Even like sleeping or something like that is somehow culturally conditioned. And what I'm trying to point to is how money comes into this equation and how there is kind of this movement from this wanting to sleep to consuming sleep, and how money plays a role in that. And I think this very extreme case of people who die of hunger, or they don't have enough to eat, or they don't have a place to stay, this is a very interesting point, and a very interesting point of critique for this kind of framework. And I think I really never thought hard enough on this point. And I think if this framework has something to do with relevant, I think thinking about these issues could provide a very not only clarity to the framework, but I think it provides some kind of content that is probably not very good.
I would like to ask about the relation between money and art, because somehow I might have might not have heard exactly, but somehow I was thinking about the counter argument to the title that we have here, which is why is money more appealing than art? So I always thought that actually art was more appealing than money, at least in our culture. If you could make a point to that.
So, in a sense, what is interesting, I guess, and what's maybe you, I don't know if you point out on this direction, is how let's say the art market suggests that the specific artwork has a value. The value, the price, economic value, and how this economic value plays with the, let's say, the artistic value, or how beautiful this is, or how appealing it is. And it's interesting to think about this relationship. And my argument would be that it's the ability of money to interfere in this conversation, this discourse in our culture, as you say, and contaminate, and somehow suggest that this artwork is better than the other one, or better is a wrong characterization, but is more beautiful, let's say, than the other, suggests that money as a discourse, or economics as a discourse, has a kind of potency that aesthetics or our culture doesn't have. And I don't know if I'm making my point right, but what I'm also would argue is that art is somehow always part, or it has always to develop in this kind of context. And I don't mean just the material conditions of producing artworks, or the remuneration of artists, or how fees or economics support the artistic practice, but a whole system of valuation that is organized by money that somehow infects the process of producing art. So I think that there is no, I would say, independent or neutral standpoint evaluating or experiencing artworks that is not contaminated by this kind of economic logic. But that's somehow like the theoretical consumers of the analysis. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the argument is like the analysis of money and how money infects individual, I mean, the relationship between the subject and its environment. It's not an empirical argument. But is it, was it any at all any relevant?
Somehow now when I'm thinking that equally, I mean, based on what you said, you can also define the theoretical and abstract thesis that the value of art is actually constituted by the value of money in societies as we live in. There is no art without value, is there? I mean, so in the sense that money being the producer of every value in the society, including the value of art.
I wouldn't say that.
Because ambiguous, I mean, I found your talk a bit ambiguous on that. Like, what do you separate the money value production from other value production? What would be the alternative to money operating, to the value production that results from the money? Do you have any alternative to that? Or is maybe the whole culture structured by money and its process of distribution of value or collection of value or whatever. I mean, I'm curious whether you are a Marxist or not. It's maybe, yeah, and so
So the easy one is, I'm not a Marxist, but so first of all, there is economic value is only one system of valuation. There is other, like political, aesthetic, artistic, cultural. It's just a similar system to organize objects and relationships, and sometimes it's also the system to be able to exchange them. So in that sense, I would say that there are systems, different systems of relation. What I'm saying is the economic system, partly because of this function of money on the one hand, imitating language, on the other hand, somehow being very present in constructing subjectivity, has the ability to infect others. And also because of political, very strong political reasons, that economic value is also a system to reproduce political hierarchies as they exist now. So for all these reasons, I see that economic value somehow is dominating other systems of value. Alternatives to money, I don't know. It's like I would say that the way to really go for alternatives to this system of valuation, or somehow to be able to resist the grip of this system of valuation, has to do with finding different possible articulations of desire outside the market and language. And somehow I cannot see that there is a, and this may sound a little bit radical, that we cannot really resist money without resisting language. And I think this has to do with this idea of very structural understanding of money and the process of signification. So somehow, I don't think that we can escape money without escaping language.
There's not much to say to that. I don't know if you should take one that's room. Just in that, but I think that's actually maybe a very interesting question. Like, is there any?
No, but I mean, it's a very political point to, right?
Yeah.
To say that you couldn't separate the two. I mean, at first, I have nothing against, but I think it's actually quite like incredible. I mean, think about it, just in the most basic way, that we all just sit there, it's just like pieces of paper, and we agree to this value that's like regulated by other bodies. It's quite like an incredible step of abstraction to me that you just do it, and then you, like, by the time you're 3 years old, you kind of get the principle. So I'm fascinated by the capacity, and maybe like to just go back to the art and the money question. I mean, if you really want to be, if you want to play the dirty card, you could almost say, well, like, money is achieved by more than art. In the sense of all these kind of grandiose ambitions, money was just this kind of empty signifier, had no big ambitions. And look at everything it's been able to mitigate all of these subjective relationships. When art is, like, written manifestos and championed and been very loud, and always kind of had a very high degree of failure as soon as it's kind of permeated the, like, real social sphere. So, in that regard, if you really want to play that nasty card, in a way, something that was kind of without ambition, achieved more than very loud cries of certain art forms. So, in that way, in the sense that I understand that you're doing it, in the sense that I understand that every time we're engaging with the system, it's always a form of subjectivation, which is the main claim of art, right? It's much more pervasive. Much more people. It has a much more global impact on this good art.
Not only on art.
Yeah, no, it's got a much more global impact in general than art. What we do is just kind of marginal.
When we did the book, each chapter has artworks from different people. Some of them were even did specifically for the book. And the whole idea was somehow to create a different narrative following the narrative of the book that does not have to use language, and somehow to try to address desire on a different level. But of course this was a very naive gesture, as I understand now, but somehow just to give you a sense of motivation and direction. Because this idea that, you know, in order to go, you know, if you want to do a really radical critique, you have to go beyond language. So in that sense, we said, okay, why don't we do that? And ask some people to, you know, think about what we think and provide some works, and then put the works in a way that they communicate to each other and provide a kind of a different critique of the same things we are doing without using words, and see what happens. And of course, this is, has its own obvious problems, but it's also like a way to somehow rethink this dilemma, economics, the power of economics and the power of art. But there's also somehow, and I think this is something that I missed and somehow I remember by suggesting this kind of gesture, is that this idea of critical art and how a lot of people now are interesting and rightly interesting about the economic crisis and what to do about it, and somehow we are artists, or let's do something about that through our practice. And this is, of course, very legitimate, but somehow it has become a genre in itself, and somehow I'm of one of the people that are benefits from this kind of, oh, let's do something critical, because I'm working with theory and on money, and then, of course, people invite me. But, you know, in the beginning it was interesting and exciting, but now it's like we are 5 years in the crisis, and it's like the same discourse, and now it's like we have the critical artists going there and paid by the critical institutions to do this kind of, no offense, of course, but I didn't...
I would never position as a critical.
But I, you know, like, Goethe Institute, like, supporting critical art in Greece.
Because actually, in Marx, for instance, when you read his little chapter in the manuscripts about concept concerning money, there you have the notion of money as the greatest abstraction, and then you have also love as a kind of, as maybe the only aspect of human life that actually contradicts or reveals the falsifying aspect of the refined aspects of money. So you cannot buy love, basically, that's the basis of Marx. So he would enumerate all kinds of objects that can be bought, or relations even, but not really. So this is interesting for me, because somehow we mentioned desire as this kind of non-verbal, whatever, possible opposition to money, at least at the stage we were writing the book, because later apparently it doesn't work anymore. So I'm curious whether this kind of Marxist thinking of money resonates. I mean, I see it as, but I'm more curious.
Well, I'm not sure if money cannot buy love, but the thing is that there's this idea of abstraction, right? But I think, like, Marx goes like the opposite. Direct. So, like, you reach the same conclusion, but it starts from the concrete and goes to the abstract, while the analysis of value goes from the abstract and comes to the concrete. There is this idea of commodification as abstraction of all these kind of specificities of a commodity, like its physical substance, the desire that or the value that the utility that it confers. So it basically, by coming into the market, it becomes a kind of a price, a number, completely devoid of its properties. But then all these kind of properties come back to how do you say, to justify this value. So, of course, there is this kind of, on the one hand, abstraction in the process of commodification, but the very rationale of this kind of value comes then back in order to. So we have this kind of, let's say, almost dialectical movement in the process of commodification. I don't know why I said that. But it's just came in my mind.
Anyone else?
All right. Well, thank you very much, Yorgos. Thanks. If you want the book, the book is available.